So this is my interview with Situ Chaw Tain Luyn on, what is it, the 7th of June, 2021. So Chaw Tain Luyn, I think everybody knows you as KT. So if it's okay with you, I'll call you KT from now on.
Please do call me KT.
Okay. So let's start at the beginning. You were born in 1927?
That's right, 1927, something like 94 years ago. I'm ancient.
So, KT, talk about a little bit about your childhood and, you know, what your father did.
Okay. Peter, first, let me say briefly why KT. KT is in the Navy, because our names are difficult to pronounce. They abbreviated our names, and there were people, KP and TM and so on. And when I joined the Navy, there were two other KTs senior to me in age. And then I was the third KT, but I was only Chaw Tain without my surname, Luyn. So there were two Chaw Tains and me, the other Chaw Tain. And we had problem with our mail. My love letters were going to them, and their letters, love letters coming to me, and all that. We couldn't sort it out. Finally, when I was promoted to midshipman, I put in a request, said, may I add on my surname, Luyn, from my father? And so I became Chaw Tain Luyn, or KT Luyn. So that's how it was.
And what's the Situ?
You got that?
What's the Situ?
Oh, yes. Situ is a title that given by Burmese Tamador for equivalent to MBE in British. And it is for meritorious service in the armed forces. Then there is equivalent one for bravery, which is DSC in the British British awards. And the DSC is Thura. So you probably come across a lot of Thura and not many Situs.
Okay. So back to the beginning.
Yes, okay, right. So let me start with my childhood.
Yeah.
I was born, I mentioned, 1927. That's about 2 years after my dad has formed the first national school in Burma. And this national school was just bamboo huts. I believe you've been around Uizar Road when you were here. And there was a museum. And opposite the museum, there used to be a concert hall called Jubilee Hall. That Jubilee Hall was built by the British for concerts and so on. And then when Bojo Aung San was assassinated, then they kept his body there. And then he was buried, funeral started from that building up to the, you know, National Mausoleum. But Newin, for some reason, tore this building, this nice Victorian concert hall, but only the space is left. And that has now become the museum, the old Armed Forces Museum before they shifted to Naypyidaw. And I was born somewhere near there. And by then my dad had already started this bamboo thatch roof school for 2 years. But I had to mention to you how the school was formed. In 1920, very much like now with the Generation Z people, in 1920, the university students of my dad's generation, they felt that the British were teaching them mainly academic subjects. There was no science at all. But they had read up about science and what's happening in India and so on. So they asked the British Education Authority, so could they also learn science? And then the British said, no, you're not ready for that yet. Actually, we have been trained to be clerks and administrators in the civil service, but not in the on the technical side. So they said, please, we would like to learn science. But it was refused again. So some of them were nationalists. They decided to boycott the university, and they left the university. And then on their own, they picked the brilliant or the guys who were clever overseas, sent them overseas to India to learn science subjects, and then to come back and teach our a later generation. But for my dad, he had an English honors degree, so they sent him to the UK. And he was asked to get a diploma in education and come back and form the school. So that's the time that when he went, I was only 2 years old, he went there, and I think a couple of years, then he got a diploma and then came back. And then he was asked to start the school. Starting school for him was finding the building and also looking for the teachers and so on. But it was something that he was believed in, and he worked very hard. And donations that he collected from the public, mainly not from the rich Burmese, but mainly from the shopkeepers in this big market in the downtown near Sri Pugoda Road. From there, every day he would go there with a silver bowl, pass the shop, and they would put in 1 rupee, 2 rupees, or whatever. And that's how he built up his funds. And eventually, he also held concerts at the concert hall and for charity. And then when he got enough funds, then he had to find a place where the new school would be built. And in that area was actually military area, what they call cantonment area. So there was a big Maidan. And in the opposite side of the Maidan, they had the British medical corps and the Royal Engineers. And in between was a vacant plot. And this plot was actually is controlled by the governor. So we were told anyway, we heard it, then my dad went to see the governor. And I don't know how he convinced the governor. He got that plot. Well, which to us now is incredible that he managed to get the plot from the governor. Anyway, that plot, after he got the plot, he had to think of the design for the school. And then in those days, they were all British contractors and British architects. There was one Burmese gentleman who had been sent to England because he was good in his architecture. He came back with RIBA. He is the first Burmese with RIBA. He also was a friend of my dad. So his name was Utin. And my dad went and talked to Utin and said, Utin, would you like to design a school for us? But we cannot pay you much, but we don't have much funds. So Utin said, don't bother. He said, I don't want any fees from you, but I'm going to try out a building with the Burmese architecture. That's not seen in Rangoon. So with that, he did that design. And that design, you may have seen the school Lumbador, Gordon Road. But that design was so striking that the British wanted to build the city hall or the town hall, the city hall now, Burmese design. So they actually commissioned him. And he's the guy who did the city hall, the one you know?
Yeah, I know.
Very similar. And by the way, that's where I got married too. In those days, they had bed where the hall where you had the city hall, you allowed to you rent out for weddings and receptions and so on. So that was his, and he also got a C2 Uten. And later on, it happened that his son was a university student, and then he joined the Navy, became chief of the Navy, my mentor, so to say. Yeah.
So you went to your father's school?
Oh, I was born there. I finished up there. I never left. I've not been to any other school.
And did you?
Our house. Yes.
Primary and secondary school, all at your father's school, which is, what's its name again?
Yeah, Myoma, M-Y-O-M-A, same as my email.
Right.
It was Myoma National High School. And after the war, my dad went around the world and all that. He found out that the co-educational system is workable in other countries. So he came back and said, let's combine the two schools, Myoma Girls' School and Myoma Boys' School. And everyone thought my dad was crazy, but he made it work. And then now it's a co-ed school. Yeah.
So you did, have you got and any that, particular memories of your childhood at school?
Well, yes, but at the old school, I nearly died when I was 1 year. Yeah. I was in a pram. And this is my dad managed to save some money to buy prams. My three elder brothers never enjoyed having a pram, so I was the first to have a pram. And in the afternoon, my mom would tell my brothers to get me out of the house and go out outside in the grounds, and then keep me happy or keep me quiet. So they would get there, come out in the school compound, and then they use the pavement outside to take me there. Then they wanted to have a kind of a volleyball game. So the two brothers, the elder one and number two, stayed opposite each other about 20 feet away. And the third brother was kind of a referee. And the elder brother pushed my pram towards the number two brother. And number two brother got the pram, turned around and pushed it back to him. And this went on for a while. Then my eldest brother got a bit bolder, and he pushed very hard, and my second brother missed catching me, and it slipped from him, and it went down the drain, a 4-foot drain, and into the pavement. And I was unconscious. I was a year old.
Oh, yeah. My goodness.
Then my third brother cried and said, oh, I'm a lay. That I'm unconscious and all that. My mother came out, and my mother didn't know what the heck to do, but then my grandmother, had friends of mine, she came and she enveloped me with a tamang, a longi,
yeah,
suffocated me. I don't know what she covered me up, and that's how I revived.
Now, goodness gracious!
If she hadn't done that, I wouldn't be talking to you now.
So that is a story.
Yeah.
When you finished school, what were your plans?
Oh, and then I've got to go back a little bit. Well, we had a system where if you are fairly bright, you can get promotion in 6 months from fourth standard to seventh standard. So I managed to get this promotion. So I saved 1.5 years. So when I was at the 11th form, that was our final before matriculation, I was already 13 years.
Very young.
And then one day, my elder brother, he said, when you pass the matriculation this year, what would you like to do? So I said, I don't know. I said, I suppose I'll go to the university. No, he said, you can't do that. You had to be 16 when you go to university. You're going to waste a couple of years doing nothing. Well, I said, I really don't know. What do you suggest? At that time, our school had started sending people to Bombay, where there was the Indian Merchant Marine training ship called the Dufferin, named after the Viceroy of India, Lord Dufferin. Well, that training ship had been in existence for about, I think, about 10 years. And then some of our senior boys had been there. And my dad actually also liked the idea that we should be sending our boys for future merchant marine. But he never encouraged me. But my brother said, "Oh, why don't you go? They wear nice uniforms and so on." I'd never been away from home, and I didn't have any idea about the sea. I couldn't swim. But anyway, I took his advice and set for the exam, and I managed to become second. There was actually selecting three cadets every year, two for the nautical navigation and one for engineering. I wanted engineering, so I picked engineering. But the guy who came number three was a friend of mine. His father was a PWD engineer, civil engineer. So he said, "Chotain, why can you swap with me? Because my dad wants me to be engineer." I said, "No problem. I'll just swap with you. No problem." So I swapped and I became navigator. So that's how I went to the Dufferin, wanting to go to sea.
Yes? So that was early 1940s, like 1941.
Hadn't
the war already started?
Not yet. Not yet, a year before.
Not yet in Asia.
Yeah. No, correct. Yeah, yes. You're right.
How did you travel to Bombay? Oh.
Well, in those days, there were no flights. You had to take a steamer to Calcutta. It's 4 days. And then take the train from Calcutta to Bombay. It takes overnight. Quite a long journey. But I remember that going to India, to Calcutta from Rangoon, the steamer was Hong Kong Chinese steamer. And the crew were Indonesian, and we were traveling second class or intermediate class, and that the cabin at the back, and it was noisy and just stuffy and all that, and I got seasick for the first time, and I regretfully joined the ship, but that was the only time that I got seasick. Later on, I was okay.
So you went across to Bombay, and how long were you there?
Well, the school, the course, the full course was 3 years. And the people came from all over India. They take 50 cadets every year. So the three-year course, there were 150 cadets, the junior and the second year and the seniors. And so there we met all kinds of Indians from all over India. There were Hindus and Muslims and Anglo-Indians. And among the Indian itself, there were, I don't know how many ethnic. But they have different language, you know. So we were not allowed to speak our mother tongue. That was definitely... You had to speak English. Everybody had to speak English. Yeah, it was quite strict in that respect. But we worked and lived on the ship, so we became very good friends because you know you see the guy every day, every hour. And then there was a bit of bullying, quite a lot of bullying. We are whipped, and not by our staff, by senior cadets. And they use the end of the rope instead of a stick or a cane, and then you got accepted whether you like it or not. So with tough training, but come to think of now, I'm glad that I went through that because I learned a lot about discipline and how to be fair with everybody and how to be confident, and that was something that that I gained in India. On the third year, after we pass, we are supposed to join a merchant ship and serve our what they call pre-sea training for another 3 years before we can sit for the navigator, the first examination for navigator to become a third officer. Well, I was very keen to get the ship quickly and then join and as early as possible, get my sea time, and I'm hoping that I would be a master mariner very soon, before 30. So that was my ambition. And in those days, unlike now, when you join these companies, you had to make indentures. These indentures call for 3 years on the ship or with the company that you cannot run away. And then you had to give a security bond of 500 rupees. So normally it would have been all right. The family would have, found the funds to just. Unfortunately, when I finished up with the Dufferin at the end, there was war already going on in Rangoon. The Japanese already occupied Rangoon, and my family had evacuated up country. So there were no means of anyone paying my 500 rupees. And this the Indian company that I was joining insisted on having the money. So the captain reported this to our governor in Simla. And the governor sent his military attaché to come and check on the Burmese cadets on the ship. And he met me, and then this guy talked to me, and he talked to the captain, and he went back and told the governor. And I think he probably said good things about me. So the next thing I knew, I had a letter from the governor congratulating me on my success for getting some prizes. And then there came a cable to the captain. The captain called me one day, and he said, "Here is a telegram from the from your governor to him. It says the HE, the governor, Sir Reginald Donman Smith, desires that Cadet Chautain should join the Burma RNVR, and he's offered a commission."
So you called it the what? Did you call the abbreviation? The join the what?
Join the Burma RNVR. That means Burma Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve.
Okay.
Now let me explain about that. This is in when the war broke out in 1939 in the UK and Europe. Most of the British expats were expected to go back to UK and fight, right? Join the forces or whatever. But a lot of the commercial guys didn't want to go back and fight. So they thought if they started a volunteer, a naval reserve, then maybe they'd escape conscription. So I think they proposed to the governor. And the British government agreed the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, Burma Division. So in short, Burma RNVR was formed in 1940. So, and anyway, most at that time, a lot of British expatriates joined, and a few Burmese who were actually university graduates. And they came from their university. Mainly, they were ex-members of the University Boat Club. University Boat Club had a patron called Sir Arthur Egger. He is the father of the University Boat Club, as you know now, the rowing club you see on Inner Lake. I think you've seen it.
Oh, yes, I have seen the rowing club.
Yeah, right.
What was his name again?
And Sir Arthur Egger.
Edgar.
Yeah, Edgar. And there was actually his bust statue at the club, you know, which during Japanese time was removed and put in a corner. And then only later on after independence, it was revived and they put back. And it's still there now. Yeah. So he is the founder. And so he encouraged the Burmese who joined the rowing club. And these guys mainly joined the British firm, British companies, and then they joined the Burma RNVR. And some of them evacuated with the British to India. And they were the remnants of the Burma RNVR force. When I joined in Calcutta in 1944, there were about 300 of us in all. Anyway, then the captain said, yeah, this is what the governor wants you to do. So I said, sir, I cannot contact my family. As you know, they are in Japanese, under Japanese occupation. So I really don't know what I should do. I came out to go as a merchant marine officer for training and then go on as join the merchant marine. I said, but for Navy, I'm not sure. So the captain looked at me and said, Chautain, he said, look, he said, your governor represents our king. If our king says jump to it, you jump to it. So I said, yes, sir, I jumped to it, saluted, and that's how I got in the Navy. Yeah, everything was forced onto me more or less, but I'm glad. Anyway, then they sent me a telegram and a radio run. I was supposed to report to the what they call Railway Transport Office and a Bombay Victoria Terminus train station one fine morning. So I packed my things and then I went there and reported to him. And then he said, all right, you go to that from so-and-so, so-and-so, coach so-and-so, so-and-so. So I went. In those days, we don't have suitcases, you know, and we have tin trunks, heavy tin trunks. So I dragged that along and I got in. And that coach was empty when I got in. So I was quite happy. And I got and found myself a bed. And before the train left, a group of Americans rolled in. Loud and unruly. And you know, they were, you know, happy-go-lucky guys got in. And then I was the only outsider. And there were, I think, a platoon of them. And when the train started off, they made friends with me. And they were having beer and all that. So asked me to take beer. I said, no, I said, I don't drink beer. Then he said, okay, then you have gum. After you have gum, they were asked. So I was introduced to the American chewing gum at that time, I remember.
You're chewing still gum. Very young, aren't they you? Call You're it only 17. You're still
I
very
was
young.
Actually, yeah, right. That's right. Actually, I was underage.
Yeah.
Maybe you should have joined when you're 18. I was a year underage. Anyway, the governor didn't, and maybe didn't know that. But when I got in, I was to change trains at Calcutta and then take the train to Chittagong by another line. And I was told by the captain, whatever you do, when you report in Chittagong to the commanding officer of Burma RNVR, who is also naval officer in charge of Chittagong, that you make sure you wear your best dress, you know, our best, uniform. So I said, yes, I said, I'll remember that. And then when I got to Chittagong, I went to the dressing room, took a shower and changed and put on my best uniform, which was a blue coat, double-breasted with buttons, gold buttons, and all kinds of, badges and so on. And then white trousers. So I went to the British RTO, a sergeant major, and Sergeant Major, I would like transport to the naval headquarters. He looked at me. Then he went to the phone and he called. He rang. In those days, the phone, you got to ring. You got to turn the handle and ring. And he said to the other side, he said, the naval headquarters, he said, here, I have a Chinese general. Who wants to come to your headquarters? Yeah. And so, well, they said, they were surprised, but they said, they will send somebody along. So I went and sat in the bench nearby, and this guy is talking to his mates, no? And he's telling them, within my earshot, he says, you know, in my job, I get all kinds of people from all kinds of allied forces, all kinds of uniforms and generals, but this one is a Chinese one. No, actually, Chinese, he meant with Chiang Kai-shek Chinese, you know, white Chinese.
Yeah.
If you remember KMT. Well, its reason was obvious later on, but I didn't know. I had the cadet tabs, you know, the tabs like brigadiers have on the collar.
Right.
This kind of a ribbon, a short ribbon. That is meant for generals and brigadiers. And we cadets had that. So that put him off. He wanted to make sure that he's here. So he thinks, man, looking Chinese. So that's how it was. Then, I mean, about 10 minutes later, a jeep rolled in. A British lieutenant commander got down from a British guy from the jeep. And he went to the sergeant major. He said, where's the Chinese general? So that guy says, he's sitting over there, sir. So I was just sitting. This guy came to me. He said, you Chinese general? I said, no, sir. I'm Cadet Chau Tain from the Dufferin. Oh. He says, that I've been got orders to join. Oh, he says, then I think they made a mistake because of your depth. Then anyway, you get in. So he helped me carry my trunk as well. You know, the British lieutenant commander. So I got in there in the jeep, and then we drove to the headquarters. Then the first guy I met was the commanding officer of the Burma Navy. He was actually a classmate of Mountbatten.
Wow.
You remember Lord Louis Mountbatten?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They were in Royal Navy together, and he retired as a commander. But he was recalled when the war broke out, and he was sent to Burma to form the Burma RNBR.
And so he was British. He was promoted to, this man was British.
He was okay, Royal Navy. He went. He's same batch as Mountbatten, so you can imagine from Dartmouth. Yeah, 100% British, but nice old man. Very nice old man. Anyway, his name was Kenneth. Second name was Sidebottom. I don't know why. Kenneth Sidebottom Lyle. Surname was Lyle, or K.S. Lyle. Oh, he was I liked him very much. And he only told me eventually when he was retiring, the last day of the inspection, he came on the, I was in commanding of a gunboat then, he came for inspection and we sat in front. And then I've got a picture somewhere, I can send it to you. Then that picture, he made an enlargement and he wrote at the back, he said, Chau Tain is the one day when you become commanding officer of the Burma Navy, you might be amused to see yourself with the first commanding officer and signed Kenneth S. Lyle. But that never happened. That never happened. Anyway, that he thought it would be that. Anyway, that's part of the story. Yeah. So that's how I got in. But actually then, are we okay for time? I'll look a bit more on this.
All good. All good.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, then he said, we have two divisions. One is the Leningrad wing, based in Chittagong. We're preparing the assault on Arakan with small Leningrads. And the other one is the flotilla, which is the gunboats. And they are also, they are the escort for the Leningrads, but they do more patrol at the sea and so on. So which one would you like? So I thought the small Leningrads were something that I didn't want because I needed some sea time for my future for the Merchant Marine. So I said, sir, I would like to run the flotilla. Okay, said, in that case, you better take the troop ship back to Calcutta and join the flotilla. But you can stay overnight at the barracks in Chittagong. But first, go and report to officer in charge, Lieutenant Tham Pei. Tham Pei actually was the first Burmese naval officer in history. Yeah. So he was in charge of that Leningrad, yeah. And yeah, of the Burma RNB. When he joined, he was the first Burmese. And he happened to be a pet of this Sir Arthur Egger. And Tampi himself became commodore of this boat club. And his bus was there. It's now here. Tampi eventually did become chief of the Navy, but he wasn't chief of the Navy right away. He succeeded my mentor. But that's another story. Anyway, Tampi, I went to report to him. He looked at me and he said, which school are you from? So I said, from Myanmar. Oh, I know Myanmar. I said, I used to go there. And I know your brother, he was in the Navy. He said, yes, sir. But I said, I'm not touch with them. Anyway, he said, oh, are you coming to join us? I said, yes, but I'm going to the flotilla. All right, he said, but if you want to stay here, you're welcome. Anyway, I said, I need some sea time. So next day, I was put on a ship called the El Medina, the trooper running between Calcutta and Chittagong, up and down. The voyage is 3 days, no? But it is across Bay of Bengal in the shallow waters. So this El Medina, when I reported, happened to be the ship that I would have joined if I had my 500 rupees. And then I would have been on that ship. Yeah. But it didn't end there. Eh? So I was on that ship as a passenger. So this time. So on the way, I wanted to learn a bit more of gunnery and so on. And at the back of the ship were Royal Navy gunners. They were what they call defense equipment merchant ship, DMS squad. They have a 4-inch gun, and they are kept there in case they had to defend against a submarine or with the enemy. So these guys, there were 8 of them, and they were they used to go out to stay on the gun platform, clean up and all that. Anyway, I went there and then I made friends with them, and I tried to learn whatever I could about the gun. And eventually I got off at Calcutta. And I got off the ship. The ship went back to Chittagong. And on Monday, I was reporting to the Burma RNB flotilla. Then the guy there said, how did you come from Chittagong? I said, I came by the ship El Medina. He said, look at the paper. He said, she sunk. I said, what? she was torpedoed day after I left. Yeah. And that is very strange. And she went down. But I got the story that the 8 gunners, 7 of them were down below having tea, and they were lost. But one gunner was on the keeping watch on the gun, and he was blown clear of the ship, and he was safe. Mm. So, you know, that's
you're part lucky. Of the fortune. But, you're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, I was lucky. I've been lucky for 9 times. Well, that's another story.
Luck has followed you throughout your life.
Well, Peter, this is something that I don't talk about very much. This 500 rupees that I didn't have, that changed the fate of Burma. Well, I see that.
So explain.
Explain. No, good. All right. Okay. I joined the Navy because I didn't have 500 rupees. So when I got in the Navy, I joined as now we're in Calcutta and so on. And then eventually we did the invasions of Akyab and Chokpyu, eventually Rangoon. And then we fought in the Delta. All that's fine. And then we got an independent 1948. 1949.
Sorry, can I just stop you there for a second, KT?
Yes.
Just tell me the story you told me about the handover in 1948 with the Burmese and their superstition.
Oh. That is the third time that I nearly lost my life. So my first time was in the pram, right?
Right.
I told you about that. Second time was on the Dufferin, but I'll skip that.
Yeah.
You know, the third time was there when I joined the Navy. And then I was already a lieutenant. I was already staff officer to be chief of naval staff. And then, you know, we decided when you got independence, our head of state would be Shan Sobwa. Sobwa means Maharaja, Shan Chan Chief. And in rotation, after 4 years from Shan to Pama, and then Karen and Chin and so on. So the first one was Shan Sobwa. He was, Shan State, he came from Shan. He was very royal because he'd been educated in England. And then he behaved like a king, more or less, in his own state. And so he told the committee for the independence celebration. They said on the independence day that he would like to go in a royal barge. Do you remember the royal lakes, the other one near the city? Not in our lakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, royal lakes that near the zoo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he said he would like to take a royal barge around that lake and let the people stand along the shore, foreshore, and wave out to him. And this is like they do in the UK with the Royal Barge. They have the Royal Britannia and so on. So there was something like that. So he told this committee about 1 month before the independence. So the committee, there's something to do with water, and so he said, came to the Navy. He came to my chief and my boss and said that this is what the president would want. Would you please try and arrange this for the president? So he said, do you see what he could do? Then he called me. I was his staff officer operations. He said, young fellow, actually, my nickname to him was Chartek. Chartek in Burmese means young fellow. Yeah. So he said, Chartek, says, go to the shipyards and see if they can do a royal barge for the president. So there were three shipyards in Rangoon at the time. So I went to the first one, the government one. And they said, yes, we can do one. But when do you need it? I said, in a month's time. No way. He said, this is something you got to design and do properly. It takes 3 months. So I said, that's no good. So I left them. I went to the fourth shipyard. And they said the same thing. So then I said, maybe the only one left, the Aeroldy Flotilla, now called IWT. In those days, it was Scottish-owned. The famous Aeroldy Flotilla would send a riverboat all the way to Bamo and Michina by Mendeley. So, yeah, they have a big shipyard. So they said, yeah, they could do it also at 6 weeks. And no. So then I said, I came back and I told my chief, sir, I said, no go. I've been to police shipyard. They all said they take more than 1 month to do this. Then he said, come on, you figure out something, man. He said, no, he just like that. He said, he just chased me off. Huh? More or less. He was really testing me, I think. So I got back to my office and figured out. Then I went home. I couldn't sleep. Then I said, what the heck to do? Got to do something. Then I remember. Do you remember a Jeep during the war? World War II Jeep, yeah?
Yeah.
It's a personal carrier, right?
Yeah.
Well, they also had a thing called Duck. Duck was a Jeep modified to go in the water as well on the road. Have you seen them?
No.
Yeah, well, they've got photos of that. It is built around the Jeep, but it has a boat shape, a bow, and then got a propeller at the back. So you can drive into the water and slowly move in the water.
Right.
You know, and then climb up again. So that was used for crossing the rivers and lakes and all that during the war, during World War II, mainly in Europe. also in Burma. So I remember those jeeps. So I thought if I had a couple of these, I put them together in tandem, side by side, made a platform, and then we can build some kind of a makeshift royal barge out of gold paper and bamboo and whatnot, you see. So I went to the British Army. They were packing up at that time for going home in a few months. So I asked them if I could borrow a couple of these tucks from them. They said, take two. It's all right, no problem. You can return after you finish. So I got these two from them, drove it down to the lakes, and then I got my Navy carpenters to make a platform side by side. And then after that, the two boats, if you can imagine, side by side, have two engines and two cockpits or two driving seats.
Sure.
So I had a young fellow, my junior, on the next one, and I was in this one, and we could maneuver slowly out of that. We could move out slowly. So then I was quite happy. Then I called the celebration committee. He said, now you can do your barge on top of that. And you know, so they got it done in 2 weeks. When everything was finished, it was about 20 feet high. You know, where this, have you ever seen the Royal Barge replica in Royal Lakes?
Yeah, the restaurant.
The restaurant, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You see the shape in front with two, what do you call it there? Well, it was a miniature of that. A miniature, something like that. I've got a picture of that too. I can send this to you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was done. And then I want to take it out for trials one more time because it's got a lot of, or what we call, you know, windage or higher. I want to know how they maneuver. They said, no, don't do that. So if you take it out and if you damage it, we have no time to fix it. So I had to just take for granted that it'll work. See? So on the 4th of January, do you know what time we got independence from the British?
I do happen to know, but no one listening will know.
Yeah, you know. What is the time that
4:20 a.m.
Yes, but the British didn't have that. They wouldn't have it. You know that. They said, we don't work before breakfast. Yeah. They said, we have our, you can have your independence 8 o'clock, 0800. But if you want your own independence, you do your own. We're not part of it. That's a real, real story. You know that?
Yeah. I didn't know until you
told
me.
We did that on our own. That 4:20 at the secretariat where Aung San was murdered. And then the governor's ceremony was at 7:30 at the government house. That has been demolished already. And the governor would hand over to the president with a march pass and so on at 8 o'clock. Then he would drive down to the port where HMS Birmingham was alongside, ready to take him off. So he went out 8:30. The president was there to send him off. He went out with his cruiser. You know, he didn't just pack up and go. You know, it was very, very royal. It was all done that way. But the official time, 4:20 in the morning, was astrologer's time. And I don't know whether the solid was correct, but I'm not quite sure. I think they got the wrong time, if you ask me. Anyway.
Did you participate?
Yes. Ah. Now, and then at 4:20, they had this celebration. And then at 8 o'clock, the governor went away, 8:30. And the president wanted this royal barge tour about 1100 or something. I forget the time itself. Anyway, we waited for him. He came in his silver Rolls Royce that the British had given him, as a present. He came on board and we piped him on board like a naval ship. And then we set off. And there were his lady, Maharani, and himself sitting in front, plus the president, the prime minister, Unu, and his wife, the four of them in front. And there were other cabinet ministers around them. And there was a dancing troupe in front of them. And there was a Burmese band playing music. And we went off. And my cockpit was in the middle. And very difficult to see from where I was because of these people sitting in front and people are dancing. So I had to lean out and then try and see where I was going. And the boat went out slowly, crawling slowly. And I managed to maneuver all the way to the eastern side. When I got there, I turned around and come back to the marina. That time, the wind had come up, and the wind was from the back. So the wind got more force, which pushed us because of our uphang. And then we were going along faster than we could go on our propeller. But we were also going sideways. It's very hard to maneuver. So I tried to do my best to get it straight. Then what we had forgotten was this barge was surrounded by right round with a board up to the water's edge, and then they put the gold leaf and gold water and paper, decorated paper and all that at the side. And at the back, the exhaust should have been kept open, but exhaust was obscured by this board. So the fumes were going inside the boat, round, and circulating inside to my cockpit, and I was breathing them. And then I felt that, it is not quite... In those days, I didn't realize, quite stupid, that you cannot just, get in the fumes and then breathe fumes and not get in trouble. So I thought I could just manage with a handkerchief, my nose, Anyway, I felt a bit funny, but I knew that something was not right. Somehow I struggled and got the boat alongside and with a bang, and my seaman just jumped over and tied up, and everyone left. The president left and the others left and so on. Then I passed out completely. When I passed out, the guys were fanning me and so, and they got a doctor to revive me. I said. And then I finally saw surface, and then the doctor said, "Oh, Boji," he said, "you are very lucky. In a couple of seconds or in a couple of minutes more, you'll be dead." So that was closest I've been to my deathbed. And that was when I was 21.
20, yeah. That's still very young. Yeah. So,
yeah, can you imagine? I wouldn't be talking to you if that nobody would thank me for doing that.
Did you see action against the Japanese?
Oh yes, a few times. Yeah. The toughest time was the famous time that the people talk about Japanese been eaten by crocodiles in Ramuri. Have you read about that or heard about that?
No, I haven't.
Ramuri Island is below Chokpyu, part of Chokpyu. Chokpyu is the harbor north of the big island called Ramuri. And it is from the main line about 5 miles, across. The Japanese were in Ramuri, and they were told there were about 5,000 or 10,000 of them. The British wanted to, they attack or made ambitious amphibious landing on the Arakan, mainly to secure land for airfield. As Slim came down the Irrawaddy towards Rangoon, where they needed air support and they need short flight fighter bombers with the airfields close by. So their plan was to take aircraft and Chokpyu and then down to another place called Tanwe, so that you get near Rangoon. So Chowpiu was the aim to for the second airfield. Aircap was invaded, but the Japanese knew they were coming. The Japanese evacuated, so there were no opposition. But Chowpiu, we had a hell of a tough opposition for the Japanese from the north. Then the Japanese went inland, down Ramri towards south, and then they wanted to go to the mainland across Ramri. And Ramri itself is an island with full of mangroves, and there's no road, only water and mangroves. Yeah. So infested with crocodiles. So they were inside Ramri, and there were about 10 creeks that they could come out from. So we had our gunboats and the landing craft blocking each of the creeks so that they'll go past us to get to the mainland. And when we first took station there, the first day they came out in their landing craft, armed landing craft, and they encountered us in the creek, and there was fighting, close fighting, and their boats were sunk, and they got in the water, but they would not surrender. They just wouldn't come. They were swimming, but they went back to the mangroves, and they disappeared. That's how not one of them surrendered. But then I was told that it's also in the books they've written later on. They were eaten by crocodiles. I think they were starved, and not everyone was eaten by crocodiles, but they perished there. So that was the toughest one that we came across. Now, compared to that, Rangoon invasion was nothing.
Now, I think probably to give you some rest, can we do one more story? And then I was thinking the other story was, you can do any parts of it, but, you know, the gun that saved Rangoon, you know.
Yeah, that I think that would for more or less what you call my complete is the thing, my theme about 500 rupees. Okay, so we are now at Day of Independence, right?
Right.
A year later, 1949, although we got independence, we already had people fighting the government. Started with the communists. The communists never wanted independence the way Aung San agreed. They thought Aung San sold out. So they, when they came back to Rangoon with Aung San after the delegation to come back, they were telling the public that Aung San sold out. And then there was a lot of misunderstanding. Then they went underground. But they were not yet declared, unlawful. They went underground. And then after communists went underground, then there were the irregulars of Aung San's army. Aung San had an army of about, I think, 15,000. And the British only allowed 5,000 into the Tamador, to the British. So 10,000 of them were hanging around, and Aung San told them, you stay put, and in case British don't give us the independence, we have to fight for it, so you hang on. So they stayed in the villages, and they became guerrilla fighters. And some of them agreed with the policy of Aung San government. After Aung San assassinated, they split into more or less two groups. Socialists, and there were the group that belonged to UNU. Well, what they call PVOs, People Volunteer Organization, they also split into yellow and white. So yellow went underground, and white stayed with the government. So there were two factions already fighting the government. And then the current at that time also wanted separate state. But they hadn't gone against the government, but they started having their own little force. They called KNDO, Karen National Defense Organization. KNU was the Korean National Union, which is the political wing, and this KNDU was the army. But they took over 20 town near Rangoon and the canal. And then they told UNU that they will guard this place for the government so that the communists cannot come through. So UNU consented with that. They started there. And then, you know, in Rangoon, you know, Alone, this west of Rangoon,
yes.
Southwest.
Yep.
Yeah. Alone had Korean quarters in those days. A lot of Koreans were settled down there. So for one day, their quarters were, somebody set fire. And the story is that it was Nguyen who started it, but it was not confirmed. Anyway, so the Koreans had to run away from that alone, and they ran all the way to Insein, where there's a bigger colony for the Koreans. And so they went in into Insein, and then their KNDOs also felt that they should guard their people, so they went in and they secured Insein. They took over Insein government and police force and all that, and they were inside. And then at that time, Burma didn't have any seasoned troops near Rangoon. The only battalion that was out with full strength was in Arakan, the 5th Burma Rifles. They were fighting the Mujahids. And then the 3rd Burma Rifles were in the Delta. Half of them had gone underground, had become communists. The other half had led by Colonel Chimyain, that's a Major Chimyain, the number second in command, were loyal ones. And they were only about 200 of them. So we were very, very scarce about professional troops. And there were Chin Battalion, was the only one that is in Rangoon. And so they could not go into Insein, take over. So we had to just surround Insein and make sure that the Koreans wouldn't come out. Well, there were a lot of sniping and firing. And then at that time, I'm talking about January 1949, the chief of the Tamador Army was the British appointed General Smith Dunn. He's a professional trained general, Smith Dunn. And he, at that time, depended on the two Korean battalions who were loyal to the government, because the Burmese battalions were not trustworthy and not professional. So to guard Rangoon, he stationed two battalions, one in Purong at the time, and the other one in Tangu. These are the two highways leading to Rangoon. Now, you can picture that, yeah?
So
anyway, yeah. So I'm talking about the one that concerned us is the 2nd Korean Rifle at Pye and Prome. So this battalion then felt that their relatives in Insein might anytime be, you know, their danger. They might be killed by the Burmese were surrounding them. So they were worried that they discussed, and I think they also got signal from Soba Uji, the current leader, to defect or to come and help the current in Insein and take Rangoon. So overnight they changed sides, and then they got their trucks, plus they commanded the civilian trucks, altogether about 200 vehicles, plus they got a light tank and a brand carrier. And they had 25 pounder guns and mortar, Gorkha platoon mortar. And they finally came down to this Prome Highway. And then when we knew about it at the War Office, we sent the Air Force to stop them. Air Force had at that time, a couple of Spitfires. The second in command at that time was Wing Commander Clift. He was a Battle of Britain pilot, by the way. Wow. He took off in a Spitfire, and he tried to stop them. But the Spitfire too fast, so, and he overran them. He didn't hit them. But his range was also, he couldn't do another sortie. He came back, and he reported that morning. He said, sorry, he said, we missed it. I can do another one if you like. So by then, the Koreans had got to Zigo. It's about 140 miles from Rangoon. And then and at that time, Nguyen has replaced Smith Dunn. Smith Dunn was given voluntary leave to go on retirement. Nguyen had taken over, but he never actually took part in any kind of operational meeting where you have to suggest or order what you should do. He left it to the people who are junior to him, but who know a bit about fighting. Anyway, we were scratching our heads. And by the way, at that time, every department of the army had a British advisor. But the agreement was a defense agreement for 5 years. The British would be stationing British military mission headed by a major general. So the meeting took place at that time. All we spoke in English, and only person or only department or wing that didn't have a advisor attending was the Navy. We didn't need one. We had one commander who was staying off, but he didn't attend this meeting. I was the only one, and I was sent as a Navy representative, the only guy in a white uniform. And I had a lieutenant stripes. So when I first attended the meeting, the G1, the colonel in charge, looked at me and then thought I was too junior. So he phoned my boss and said, Commander Bo, can you send somebody senior to this fellow here? So Bose replied, I believe, he said, hey, this is my staff officer operation. Whatever he says is what I say. And he put the phone down. So they accepted me, but they never called me by my name, lieutenant, so and so on. They just called me Navy. Hey, Navy, that's it. Anyway, I stayed in my place and I didn't talk too much. I just wanted to listen to them. They went on and then, he said, how are we going to stop these currents? Yeah. So we don't have enough force to go and stop them. And they'll be in Rangoon in less than 2 days' time. Then one staff officer said, yes, we have the nearest troop that we can bring is in the Delta on the third Burma Rifles. Third Burma Rifles. Who is the second in command, who is in charge, as I told you earlier, half of the battalion had gone underground. So they were the only one available, but they could not come through 20 Canal because the Koreans had occupied it. Right. So there's no way. So how are you going to bring them there? They were actually, this is a puzzle that they couldn't solve. So then I put my hand up. He said, oh, Navy, what is it? So I said, sir, I said, there's a route which was used by the British before the canal was built. You can come through the route at night or at the high water, and then you'll be able to get across to Rangoon with a detour. And then he said, how do you know? I said, I've been on the route. I know. I said, when I was commanding officer of the naval gunboat. So they said, all right, that's a good idea. I said, say, well, let's do that. So I said, we'll send one of our gunboats to escort them. So that's how we brought in the two double-deckers carrying troops from 20 through this canal at night. Not the canal, the route, the short route, the long route. Then they were they arrived at Rangoon early in the morning, and they were given a one-day rest, and they were asked to go up and fight the Koreans coming down the highway, the mechanized force. So the major, Kim Yang, at the time major, he said, I'm not refusing to go. He said, my guys will go, but we have no heavy weapons. We only have Bren gun as our biggest weapon, but they've got the 25 pounders, and they got the tank, and they got the Bren carrier, and they are professionals. So one guy said, oh, we have a 6-pounder gun, which we are training the university students, and they know how to shoot, but they have never been in action. So we can send that. Oh, all right, says that, that's good. But then Chim Yang said, they've got two artillery pieces. We only have one. And no, we are not outmatched. So again, they were quiet, and they didn't know what they had to do. Then I put my hand up again. Yes, Navy, what do you want? So I said, we have in the Navy a Beaufort gun on wheels, which we got from British Army, that we use for training. We could send that mobile Beaufort. Oh, good idea. Yes, okay. So two against two. So that's what decided. And then we said, all right, we will go. We do that and start from Rangoon next morning. I went and reported to my boss what happened in the meeting. So, all right, young fellow, it's a good idea. You go down the barracks and go and arrange. So I got in a Jeep. In fact, the Jeep was driven by, I got a lift from Wing Commander Clift. He drove me down to Monkey Point all the way through Rangoon, but he drove like he was driving a Spitfire. I remember. I was very glad to get off that Jeep. Anyway, so I went to the Navy mess, and with just about lunchtime, and I said, hey, fellas, any volunteers for Beaufort's party? So everyone quiet. Then one guy said, where to? I said, if you are going, I'll tell you, but I cannot tell you before you, unless you go. So he's silent. And nobody volunteered. So I felt that, I could have asked one of them to go in the name of my CO, but I thought, well, I'll sort it out later on. So I went to the ratings barracks, seamen, where they were already having lunch. So I got in and I said, hey, naval party, the naval Beaufort's party. So a lot of them jumped and came over, shouted at me, said, where are we going? So I said, I can't tell you, but don't worry. I said, we are going to get show messing allowance. So in Navy, we look forward to, serving outside the unit. So you get a daily allowance, or so you can buy your own food. So this is what we said, you get that, all right. So anyway, they said, oh, if you're going, we're coming. So I got, I think about 12 guys. And then then one young fellow came to me and said, sir, may I go? I look at him. He's about a little younger than me, or a couple of years younger. I said, you are only a bugler. You're not a seaman. You're not a gunner. How can you? Why? We don't need you. So I said, let me come because I've never been in action or in operation. So, but I can carry ammunition, he said. So that boy actually was the youngest in our group. And he eventually became leader of the Navy band, and eventually retired as a lieutenant commander after he'd been to Royal Navy, got his musical training and all that. And he also was he used to sing on the TV. So he was the youngest guy. Yeah. People know him as Charlie. No, Charlie, he was youngest of the group. Without him, we'd have been 13. I said, this is a bad number. So I let him come. Yeah. So now to cut the story short, we managed to ambush them at night. This is a long story. So anyway, we managed to stop them, and though they that and they were eventually they evacuated from their vehicles and they ran away and left their arms and ammunition all that intact. So,
but you were 11 against a couple of thousand, is that right?
Well, not exactly. I had 180 soldiers.
Okay.
They did all the fighting, but the first action was my own, because you know there's no chance that we could face them at night in the daytime. Yeah. We would be overrun, you know. So we had to think of a way how to stop them. And the only way to ambush them at night in the dark, yeah.
But you made it seem that there were many more of you. I think you made them think you had much stronger forces than you actually had.
Yeah, the reason was that we were firing automatic. So when you fired a Beaufort automatic, for four shots at a time, they thought that they'd admit it later on. When we captured the CO and the second command, they thought that we had some outside help from some other country, perhaps India, with a battery of artillery, because of the automatic fire of the Beaufort. So that's why they gave up, and they felt another reason why they gave up was they had their families with them.
Mm.
So the family would also be killed. So that was another reason. And they were tough guys. Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, they are professional. They tried to attack us a few times, but this gun with automatic help. Anyway, so that is a story in the book, but I cannot. It'd be a long story. But
That's fine.
Yeah, what I want to say is that. We saved Rangoon, okay?
Yeah.
Because of the gun. The gun saved Rangoon. But, Peter, what if I didn't have 500 rupees? What if I had 500 rupees in 1941 or in 43 when I was to join the Merchant Marine? If I had my 500 rupees, I wouldn't have joined the Navy.
Yeah, your life would have been very
different. Somebody else, that's fine, but somebody else would be in charge.
Right.
At that time,
I just
he may not do the crazy thing I did.
I just want you to finish with one story that does take place with gun that saved Rangoon, and that's how afterwards how you were driving along and a truck
Well, when we fought the Koreans, I mean we were in danger, no doubt. But somehow we managed it. So we finished and then we were about to come back to Rangoon. Colonel Chinman with his troops, they went off. They said, you take care of the rear guard and we got to get back to Insein. So they went off and we were at Jobingao, which is another bigger town. Jobingao was the stronghold of the socialist government, the government socialist faction. And they were stationed there to stop the Koreans the communists to come to Rangoon. They could handle the communists, but they couldn't handle the Koreans, right?
Right.
They could handle, but they thought that they needed. If they had my gun with me, then nobody would try and attack their town. So when we stopped over, they said, please rest for one night and we want to treat you. And no, they were full of, they wanted to really help us out and all that. So we were about to say yes. Then one guy who was my classmate on Myanmar school, he came to me and said quietly, he called me to the side, he said, "Look, he's a Chotain. You better go." I said, "Why?" He said, "They want to use your gun. Your gun is the one that is saving the town. If once your gun leaves The communists will come in and they'll have a fight. So I thought at that time, if I stayed on, I'll be fighting between Burmese against Burmese. And I wasn't sent. I didn't come to do that, to help. So I said, I got to get back to my work and so on. Then I left. So I was actually driving a jeep that was meant for this. It was the jeep of the commanding officer of the Korean battalion. So it was a captured enemy vehicle. And my assistant was next to me. Two of us were driving in front. And my guys were following. I had four guys who could drive. So we got two more trucks with full of ammunition. Although they were bringing those things. And one truck was towing my Bofors gun. They were left behind a little bit at the back. So we already went on towards Rangoon. We passed a bend where we confronted an army truck rushing down fast. And we swerved to miss them, and they swerved, and then they went in a ditch. So I looked, and they got in a ditch, but they didn't overturn, so I must be all right. So I carried on. Then while I carried on, a few minutes later, I heard a truck hooting at the back and overtaking me. They overtook me and blocked the road, so I stopped. And then a lot of soldiers there from the truck jumped down with the stun guns at the ready, surrounded me. And they are in charge. I think he was a levy captain. And he said, what the hell are you doing this? Why did you not stop for us and all that? He abused us and all that. And he was trying to instigate that if we retaliate, he would shoot us. Right? I was about to touch my carbine next to me. My second in command, he said, sir, don't touch. They want to shoot you. So I just kept cool, but didn't know what the heck to do, and perhaps I might have said my prayers. Then a jeep came down, stopped by, and looked at what's going on. He saw me, and he came to me and said, Coach Yotain, he said, what's the matter? I looked at him. He was one of our ex-students from the Myanmar school. I used to play basketball with him, very much my junior, but he was a captain of the army. So I thought that these guys are trying to annoy us. So he looked at them. He said, what the hell are you all doing? These guys are heroes. They just fought the Korean. You all are, this and that. He viewed them out and chased them off. They apologized and they went. But then, but it didn't finish. I wasn't happy with that. I wanted to show them something. So I waited till my gun caught up with me. Then they were going along, and we followed them. Then when he got within a few hundred yards, I stopped the gun and I said, I told my gunners, fire overhead, just a couple of busts, about 3-4 rounds, and they fired. So when they heard the gun fire, we fired at them and they come in. So they swerved to the paddy field and ran, and that's the long ball at the back, and we fired a few more shots. Then that was the lesson I learned. At the battlefront, might is right.
So, you know? Look, KT, I think that's a wonderful story to finish with.
You think so?
And I do.
I'm glad you just...
There are many stories I know. But so if you're happy, we'll adjourn, we'll finish today, and I'll come back to you in a short time and see if we can continue your long life and wonderful stories. Because I think... this is 1949, so you're only 22, yes, and you're now 95. So I think there's a lot more for you to talk about.
My latest story is the other day coming back from Kalaw, we ran out of juice with Tesla. We were 10 miles from Rangoon, and we only had 5 miles of battery left.
You've got a Tesla in Yangon now. You have a Tesla.
I have a Tesla Y. I've been to Kalaw. This Tesla officially does 250 miles. And I went Teslas 200 miles.
How many Teslas are there in Yangon?
As far as I know, maybe about six. But Y, I think there are only three. Why the latest one?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I'll give you a ride. You go and test drive a Tesla, Peter, and then you would not only know is that very quiet is every electric car, but you drive it. This got an acceleration of a Porsche or BMW. And then diesel, you never touch the brakes. The moment you leave the lever, it brakes by itself. That's something you got to get used to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I'm just telling the listeners that you're the only 95-year-old that I've ever interviewed who is totally up to date with technology and even through to your cars. So KT, I'll stop the recording and then we'll just speak for a couple of minutes we stop. So I'll stop now, and I thank you very much for this interview.
Very welcome, Peter. Yeah, fun talking to you.